morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Kathy Donnelly and I represent the appellant, Jeremy Lasker. Your Honors, the court's order on the motion in limine is very clear, precise, and succinct. The prosecution must have instructed Ms. Miranda not to speak a word of any allegations of prior violence in the case. Similarly, Ms. Miranda's violation was as clear and as direct. She violated the court order. She spoke of a restraining order in a case. Just I would like to remind the court here, we're not talking about manslaughter, pushing to put Mr. Nolasco, but in pushing to put Mr. Nolasco, we were talking about a third degree assault case. So allegations of a prior act of violence, equivalent of the crime that he was charged with, was so great in this case that I would like to focus your attention on the details of what Ms. Miranda told the jury in violation of the direct court order not to. It was specifically about the acts between the two parties, about the defendant and Ms. Miranda, the alleged victim. It was specifically about acts of violence that, in her view, required a court order to restrain Mr. Nolasco from contacting her. And that is what she told the jury, which, by the way, happened to have been a lie, because at the time there was no restraining order in place.
And Ms. Donlan, I want to make sure that I understand your argument.
Sure.
As I understand the briefs, you're not arguing that the verdict should be impeached. Your argument is that the prejudice is shown in part by Miranda's statement to the jury.
Yes, Your Honor. Taking the risk of having to interpret your question, and I'm assuming that you're getting to the 606B issue, and I'm more than happy to address that part. That was the second part of my argument.
Oh, I'm sorry to jump ahead. I want to make sure that you covered it.
I would be more than happy to address whatever you're interested in hearing. So there are two prongs to the arguments that we have. One is the appeal of the district court's decision when he denied the motion for mistrial. And that goes strictly under the due process rights of Mr. Nolasco under the Fifth Amendment. The second part comes regarding his decision to deny Mr. Nolasco's motion for a new trial, which goes to the Sixth Amendment violation and the fact that he was denied having an impartial jury. So there are two separate arguments, and Mr. Nolasco's position is that he's not directly attacking the verdict under 606B. And I would love to actually, at this point, refer the court. I don't think that I had cited under Fifth Circuit case. I listed the cases that actually address the issue under what circumstances it is okay to go ahead and take a look at what the jury thought during the deliberation period for the only and sole and limited purpose of identifying whether the jury had lied during the voir dire. Because that is where the Sixth Amendment violation comes into place, and the question is not attacking the verdict under 606C, but whether this defendant in this case had an impartial jury.
So if I understand your argument correctly, we can look into that if the argument is not to attack the verdict itself, but to look to see whether prejudice was shown because they considered the evidence that you're saying should not have come in.
Yes, Your Honor. And it comes under the prejudice prong of the mistrial, but also it comes down, and maybe I have not explained that well, I would like to take this opportunity to do that, but it comes into play again under the denial of the motion for a new trial because of the fact that at the end of the day, Mr. Nolasco, there's no question that Mr. Nolasco had a right to have an impartial jury. And if what the investigator found out after the trial showed that a jury member lied when he was asked the question, are you able to follow the judge's instructions? And are you able to give Mr. Nolasco the day in court that he deserves, having an impartial jury who's going to follow the court's order, follow the law? And in this case, what we have is that you have a direct court order telling the prosecution, you have to instruct your witness, this particular witness, not any witness, this was not a general order. This was a very specific order. Tell Ms. Miranda not to talk about any actual violence. What happens is Ms. Miranda goes and specifically asks, talks about this particular issue. So there are two scenarios under which this happened, right? Either the prosecution did not convey the court's order to Ms. Miranda, which would have been the prosecutor's misconduct in this case, which automatically would give him the reversal on that and the double jeopardy would attach, or that the prosecution told Ms. Miranda what the court order was and she deliberately and intentionally violated it.
Ms. Tolio, is there a possibility of a third possibility, and that is that the prosecution instructed the witness not to refer to any prior acts of violence, that the witness, not being a lawyer, didn't understand that mentioning a restraining order was an implied reference to a prior act of violence. Maybe there was just an inadvertent misunderstanding as to what constitutes an act of violence.
Your Honor, I would love to live in that world, but the truth of the matter is that the prosecution knew their case. They knew what was going on. It was very much explained during the hearing on the motion in limine that this is our concern. This is a woman who has made these allegations regarding the restraining order, and because of that, we would like to make sure that the court orders and grants our motion in limine.
The prosecutor didn't elicit the testimony, though, did the prosecutor?
It was not the prosecution, and that is why I said there are two scenarios, right? It's either that the prosecution told their witness specifically not to talk about it, or they didn't. If they didn't, they were in violation of the court order. If they did and the witness decided deliberately to do that, that is again, under either scenario, they're coming down to the same position that this was in a third degree assault case. This was the heart of the issue, right?
Okay.
Whether this man.
I guess I'm concerned about what was in the victim's mind. Maybe the victim didn't realize that by saying I had a restraining order that she was implying an act of violence.
But does it matter in the context of the defendant's constitutional rights, Your Honor? We are not talking about the alleged victim's rights here. We're talking about the Constitution that specifically says you have the right to due process. You have the right to an impartial jury. And if a witness, no matter who it is, decides to deliberately taint the witness, the jury's pool, and taint their minds by an evidence that in this kind of a case, and I cannot emphasize this more, this is a third degree assault case. We're not having a mass murder case that, okay, yes, by the way, did he commit any acts of violence?
Well, is the standard for mistrial the same whether the violation of the motion in limine is inadvertent or deliberate?
Well, actually, this is the factor that the court was taking to mind, and that is my point, that it cannot be inadvertent in this case because the order was very clear. And if you look at the transcript, actually, that's the interesting part, right? So what is the question? The question by the defense counsel is, by the way, you received some texts or emails from the defendant on that day. What time was it? And then the answer is, oh, I don't know what time it was. All I know is that I have a restraining order against the defendant. Had nothing to do with the question that was posed. That should help Your Honor in determining whether this was inadvertent or it was planned.
Well, Ms. Donnelly, regardless of whether it was planned or inadvertent, what we have is the jury heard violation of restraining order.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then we have a court instruction saying there was no restraining order. So I'd like to address that piece of it. Why was that not enough to cure any type of prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. One, I would like to go back to the fact that the district judge recognized the level of prejudice that the jurist would interject into the process, and that's why he actually granted the motion in limine to begin with. This was grave enough that the judge granted the motion in limine. And you know, again, I hate to say this again, this is a third degree assault case. You are talking about somebody having a restraining order, court issued order, and this was just, again, an untrue allegation, which was not, there was no restraining order in place at the time. So the prejudice prong of this, actually, I don't know to what extent this is a constitutional harmless error at this point. So the burden should actually take it on the government to see that it's not harmless. The case law is very clear. When you're dealing with this scale, a case that the element, the main and essential element of it is whether this defendant is capable of committing such a crime, the moment the question is asked, the moment the issue is raised, the house is lost. The violation happened right there. At that point in time, Mr. Nolasco's rights, that constitutional rights to Fifth and Sixth Amendment, were violated, and the district court had a duty to go ahead and declare his trial. Interestingly enough, if that was not enough, and even if there is the argument by the government that, oh, maybe that cured the issue, you have the jury questions after they were instructed. After they're instructed not to consider this issue at all, they ask a question about the restraining order. As a trial judge, at that point, it was so clear that this jury is not following his order, that even if he had not granted the motion for this trial earlier that day, he should have granted right then. So when the issue is re-raised again in a motion for a new trial, the judge not only is aware of its own district, very direct order, the violation, the effect of it on the jury that is not following its order, even on the limiting instruction. And then on top of that, you have the investigator coming in and having the affidavit of the jury member saying that, yes, by the way, they did not follow your instructions. And we were the same bunch that told you in the beginning of this process during the voir dire system, we take the oath, we will be following your instructions. And that is the only reason they were placed on that jury, to be able to be, to form that impartial jury that Mr. Nolasco had a right to have under the Constitution of the United States. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, Ms. Donnelly, you have about 3 minutes and 11 seconds.
May it please the court. My name is Victoria Cisneros, registration number 45519, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. The ultimate issue in this case is whether the trial court abused its discretion in denying the defendant's motion for a mistrial. The people's position is that not only did the trial court not abuse its discretion, but any prejudice the defendant suffered because of the victim's testimony was not so substantial as to warrant a mistrial. In this case, during the motion in limine, the trial court ordered that the victim could not testify about any prior assaultive behavior. All indications from the record are that the prosecution instructed the victim just that. During her testimony on cross-examination, the victim was asked a question, and she responded, "I don't recall. All I know is that I had a restraining order and he was violating it." Immediately following this testimony, defense counsel moved for a recess and then moved for a mistrial based on the violation of the in limine order. The trial court found that there had been no violation of the in limine order because this statement was elicited on cross-examination, not by the prosecution, and inadvertently. Following discussions with counsel, the trial court offered two suggestions. One, instruct the jury that there had been no restraining order in place on the day of the offense, or two, allow the defendant to cross-examine and likely impeach the victim about the restraining order. At this point, the defendant made a choice. He chose to have had the jury instructed that there was no restraining order in place on the day of the offense. And that's exactly what the trial court did. When the jury returned from recess, the trial court said to them, "On August 11th, 2011, there was no restraining order. There was no order to disregard this statement to the jury. That was all that was said." Cross-examination then continued. There was a strategic choice for the defendant to do this. He used it later to attack the victim's credibility repeatedly. During closing argument, defense counsel stated, "I had to scramble to keep up with the victim's deceit," and noted that during her testimony, the victim said that she had a restraining order and that the defendant was able to disprove that. So how could they believe her on anything else? She noted to the jury that the victim lied numerous times on the stand and even asked, "Was there a restraining order?" These remarks show that the defendant made this choice to use this to his advantage during closing arguments and to attack the victim's credibility. The defendant had a hand in crafting the remedy in this case and chose not to ask to strike the victim's statement from the record or to ask the jury to disregard the victim's statement. Instead, he chose to use that. The defendant then points to the jury questions as evidence that the jury was unfocused and still focusing on the restraining order. However, that question came from a single juror at the close of the victim's testimony. This did not come during deliberations and does not show that the jury as a whole was unfocused, but rather that one single juror was still concerned about the restraining order. But we have no way of knowing when that question was written. Immediately following the restraining order testimony, the jury was ushered out for a recess. The juror could have written it at that point, but cross-examination continued after the jury returned. And so it was upon close of the victim's testimony that the trial court was presented with this list of questions. And out of that list of questions, the judge chose to ask one single question that had actually nothing to do with the trial about the victim's wages. It did not ask the victim again whether there was a restraining order because it had already given that instruction.
Well, Mrs. Cisneros, is it accurate from the record that the question was asked after the juror had been instructed with the limiting instruction that there was no restraining order?
The list of seven questions from this juror was not given to the trial court until the close of the victim's testimony. So we have no idea of knowing when that juror wrote that question. The record does not indicate that. Instead, what the record indicates is that at the end of the victim's testimony, the trial court asked any jury questions, and a list of seven questions were handed to the judge from a single juror, and those questions were listed in that seven-question list. But the trial court did not ask these questions. Instead, it said, we're not going there. We've already covered this. And so that question was not asked again after the limiting instruction.
Well, there's some evidence that, according to the exit interviews that were conducted by the defense investigator, that the jurors actually had some thoughts about the restraining order that were contrary to the court's instruction. And how does that play into the prejudice that supports the motion for mistrial?
There is some indication that the jury may have considered that. From the affidavits, it's not clear. From the affidavit, it says that there may have been some mention about the restraining order, but not necessarily whether or not there had been any prior violent acts. And as far as how that plays into the prejudice for the motion for a mistrial, I think 606B prohibits that. That gets directly into what the jury discussed during deliberations, and that is precisely the conduct that is prohibited by 606.
Ms. Cisneros, how do you meet Ms. Donnelly's argument that she doesn't want to impeach the verdict, and so therefore the 606B considerations are not valid? All she wants to do is to use that information to show that there was prejudice in allowing this prejudice in the violation of the motion in limine, or the order in limine.
One, there was no violation of the order in limine, as the trial court found. And two, the cases that the defendant cites to support that proposition are cases that deal with jurors lying during voir dire. And this court has issued an opinion directly addressing that concern. In Pena Rodriguez, any new trial request based on juror misrepresentation, counsel must have asked specific questions during voir dire. And that burden is on the defendant to prove that those questions were asked. Here, voir dire is not included in the record. So we don't know, was the jury asked, if there had been a restraining order in this case, would you feel differently? We don't know what questions were asked during voir dire, and so that issue cannot be decided on this record. Even if that is the case, because we don't have any challenge to the competency, I don't believe this court could address that issue in that manner.
Do you have any Colorado authority that states that when you're not impeaching a jury verdict, that you cannot look to evidence such as
that
this?
That is Pena Rodriguez, okay. This court's decision in Pena Rodriguez, which says that new trial based on juror misrepresentations, which would be lying during voir dire, counsel must show that the specific questions that they're using to show misrepresentations had to have been asked during voir dire. And since we don't have that record, voir dire was not included in the record, we can't address those issues because we have no way of knowing what the jury said, what biases they may have had, or if they did make any misrepresentations to the court or to counsel about a restraining order or any sort of prior violent act on the part of the defendant. Finally, a mistrial is the most drastic of remedies that should only be granted when there are no other remedies available. Here, the defendant had other remedies available. He could have asked for the statement to be disregarded or to be stricken from the record. He did not do that for the reasons discussed before. He wanted to use this to show that she was a liar, that she was not credible in any way. So how could the jury believe her? In addition, simply mentioning any prior criminal act on the part of the defendant is not per se prejudicial, requiring a mistrial or a new trial. And that's exactly the case we have here. The mention of the restraining order did not mention any prior violent acts by the defendant. She simply said, I had a restraining order and he was violating it. And then the jury was told that there actually was no restraining order in place. This was a brief mention, not elicited by the prosecution, repeatedly mentioned by the defense when they were attacking the victim's credibility. And for these reasons, any prejudice to the defendant was cured by the trial court's instruction. And if this court has no further questions, the people would respectfully request that you affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Cisneros. Ms. Donnelly?
I have 3 points to make, Your Honors. One, again, this is recharacterizing the defendant's argument in this case. The argument is not whether the jury was directly asked during the voir dire whether they're able to ignore whether there's a restraining order in this case. The issue is whether under the Sixth Amendment, the jury that swore to be impartial before deciding that they can sit as a jury in that case was able to follow the court's instruction. There is no question that in any court in the United States of America before a jury is sworn in and then they're given the jury instructions, they understand that they have to follow the court's order. There is no question that there was a court order in this case on the motion in limine. There is no question that there was a limiting instruction in this case. And again, in my second point, there is no question that the question from the jury came after the limiting instruction, because as the government conceded, immediately after Ms. Miranda opened her mouth and talked about the restraining order, the defense counsel objected. The limiting instruction was given after the court recess, right after Ms. Miranda spoke. So before that, there was no mention of a restraining order. That question came in after it was mentioned first. That was the first point in time. Immediately after that, we had the limiting instruction, and then the question comes after the limiting instruction was given. As to the 606C issue, I would like to also cite the case Maldonado versus Missouri Pacific 798F2D764, and specifically talks about the issue that are we looking into the subjective thought process of the jury members.
Have you provided a copy of that case to Ms. Cisneros?
I have not, Your Honor. This is a published opinion, and I apologize for not having done so before. But it is in the same line as all the cases that I have cited, the cases from the First Circuit and the United States, the Supreme Court of the United States. Those are all cited, and this is in line with that. It doesn't have any additional. And the only reason I'm citing it now is that it's helpful in showing the thought process as to how you just make a distinction between the time that the defendant is trying to attack the verdict.
What is the year that this case that you've just cited us was decided?
1986.
So it's not new authority?
No.
And it could have been presented in your opening brief or your reply brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm going to give you 5 days to give us a written response if you need to this case that's been cited.
Your Honor, if it makes it easier for the court, it's in line with all the other authorities that I have cited for the same proposition. So even aside from this citation, the analysis is the same thing under Gore that is cited and under McDonough Power. And they will say the same thing. So the test is, are you looking into the subjective thought process of the jury members? Or all you're doing is to see whether in one way or another they lied during the process, right, when they swore.
Thank you, Ms. Donnelly. Thank you again, Ms. Cisneros. So please direct your letter to all three of the judges on the panel, in addition to the clerk of the court, and of course, a copy of Ms. Donnelly.
Thank you, and I apologize.
But the matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes our docket for